Buddy. Adrian, don't forget to record. Okay, we're supposed to click on got it.
Yeah.
Got it. All right. Okay. Well, welcome to the May meeting. And April was a very busy month. May is not quite as busy, but one highlight is at the end of the month, we will have Boardwalk Astronomy starting up again. So let's start off with our reports and our vice president. Would you like to come and tell us all about the schedule?
Certainly. Okay. All right. Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
Okay.
All right. Let's see. With only one click, I thought I was going to do one click. Here we go. All right, now I got to get it all set to share.
Sunny and share. Nobody knows that joke, though, do they?
I do.
Okay, very good. Are you seeing the calendar out there?
Good to go.
Yes, very good. Okay, here's the 4th of May at our club meeting. Friday, we've got two volunteers. Oh, connection's not private. I know that. Turn on enhanced protection. No, I don't care about that. I just want
to. They have to go to advanced.
So I'd have to go advanced.
Advanced and acceptable.
Oh my goodness. I can't click on anything, so I'll just go back and talk about it. This is at Explore the Planet. It says Explore the Planets Day. What?
If you put your mouse over, does it bring up any info?
I don't think so. No. Explore the Planets Day. I've got two volunteers, David and can't remember who the other person is, and they're going to take that for Friday. I just want to put out a plug for everybody. Last week, we had 6 events in 1 week. Wow. I went to 5 of them, and it was hard. So we need to get lots of volunteers, okay? That's my plug. All right. Cub Scout pack Saturday at 9 o'clock. I'm not going to be able to attend that, but I saw there was 2 or 3 volunteers for that one. No. I can't remember where it was.
It's a north something park.
Right. Okay. I'm curious why I can't look at it because I'm logged in here. Larimore Elementary. I'm not sure if we're covered on that. I think I'm going to that one. I've signed up for a bunch of them. I think I'm going to that one. I'm not sure who else is doing it, so I can't look at it. Yo Youth Summit is on Saturday. Skywatch is the at 8 o'clock. We had something going on at 6 p.m. that was canceled. That was Indian River, and they wanted to vet us and for us to go in and do background checks. And we just said, we're really full. We don't have time to do that. We really got busy last time. Corn Watch the 19th, Night Watch, overnight 20th and 21st. At the end of the month, Garden Stars at 8:30. Night hike at 8. Didn't we already have a night hike last?
Yeah, there's going to be 4 of them. This will
okay.
Be the third of the 4.
Okay, now that's not the one that was lots of insects.
And this is at Northwest River Park.
Oh, okay. Oh, that Northwest River Park. It was
you
one thing.
In the equestrian area.
Right. In the equestrian? Okay,
yeah.
Good. And that's on the 26th. Saturday, the 27th, 10 a.m. I don't know what it is. I can't. It's not showing us
Saturday,
anything.
Sunday.
Saturday, Sunday, of course. Okay, very good. Let's go to the next page. Ah, am I frozen? I don't know what's going on here. I click back. I don't know what. Click forward. Oh, my goodness. Let's see if we can back bay.
Jeff, in case you can't see it in the chat, Roland said he's going to Larrymore Elementary School.
Okay, very good, thanks. Yeah, I didn't see it.
I figured you wouldn't be able to see it with all the jostling up here.
Well, I'm not going to be able to do this. It looks like I can't even get back, and now it says privacy error and all kinds of craziness. So anybody have any questions about the schedule, please do volunteer. We always need lots of help at all these events. One of them, I stick my neck out and say, hey, we can do a solar and an indoor presentation, and that's what they're doing tomorrow. So I stuck my neck out and had 2 people volunteer, and I can't even go. So I was kind of embarrassed about that. Yes.
just because I'm new here, can you give me a feel of which of these events have lots of people attending or
Which of the events have a lot of people and which? Well, that's going to be a huge one with 150. You know, I went to two events and they had 150 on one and 180, but it was all, we were bombarded with these elementary school kids. And it was a lot of fun and they asked great questions. It's really, really good. It tests your skill. And if you don't know, maybe the other guy knows, but it was a lot of fun. Always about black holes and they want to know everything there, you know. And they don't realize that there's a black hole in our galaxy and things like that. I just learned today that they think there's a black hole inside the Omega Cluster. And I didn't know that myself. So we're going to try to set up a small event and go look at the Omega Centauri Cluster.
Yeah, if you go to the calendar, click on the event, scroll down to the... It shows the details of the event. It tells how many people they expect, 30 or 100 or 300.
Right, that's true.
Boardwalk will be the biggest one.
Uh-huh, Boardwalk Astronomy. And that's at the end of May.
Yeah.
I can't remember what day, 25th. Tuesday, 25th.
The elementary school probably will have over 100 kids there.
Yeah. But it's great fun, and it's all deductible, you know, your miles and all that stuff, so... Please do volunteer. We need lots of help.
Volunteer. Don't forget to log your hours and your miles after you come back, because you can do that in the Night Sky Network. And then at the end of the year, go to the summary at the bottom or just list all your events, and it tells you how many miles and how many hours you put in.
Did everybody hear that? You need a repeat. I don't know either way. Be sure and log your hours in Night Sky Network when you volunteer. Because it's all deductible and it does give you a nice summary of all the miles and all the events you did, and especially the miles. And you'd be surprised, because I think I'm up to 30 already myself for this year. Okay, that's it for me. Who's up next, George? Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Rich, can you hear us?
Yep.
Okay, it's time for the treasurer's report.
All right.
We turn up the volume here.
Volume
up.
Let's see.
Not doing anything.
All right. So we have a lot of money.
I found it.
Go ahead.
All right. So total across our accounts. A little over, $10,000, which is historically pretty high. We have some expenses coming up, but still we're in a really good place. The good news is if you look at Georgie June, we pretty much wrapped up all our ticket sales. So all that money is accounted for, and we're sitting at $1,900 in that account. So when we pay out the scholarship in the summertime, it's $1,000 scholarship, we'll almost be fully funded for next year. So we're in a very, as we start taking places, we'll be in a really good spot. Primary scholarship, 2,500, or almost 2,600 in that account. So we'll pay out 1,500 in the summer and we'll be a good portion of the way there. We make a lot of that money from Boardwalk Astronomy. So, you know, as you heard, the first one's coming up, we get like $250 for each one of those we do. So pray for good weather. We'll have more Boardwalk Astronomies. And our primary scholarship will be in better health or in good health. But general fund, membership continues to be strong. We had 5 new members again this month. That seems to be pretty consistent. I get anywhere from 4 to 6 members new every month. And we're also getting a lot because a lot of people are signing up for East Coast Star Party. So we've probably collected over $1,000 already for East Coast Star Party, and we're pretty far out. So it should be a good event overall. I need to fix that because there's 169 members on the roster. Any questions?
Yeah, Rich, are you going to have a category in your report for the East Coast Star Party?
I can do that if you wish.
I think that would be helpful.
Yeah, I haven't tallied it up, but I have everything in the income size delineated for that. So, yeah, I could break that out if you so desire.
Thank you. Okay, are there any other questions?
Yeah, Rachel has one. Okay.
Hey, hi. I have a question in regard to grants. Is there any interest in applying for any grants? I've gotten a lot of requests to present at schools and camps, and I just wasn't sure like how to go about arranging that with the club.
So the question was how, if people are interested in having other events, how to go about it?
Yes, that, and whether or not we have any interest in applying for any grants.
I'm sure that we would look at any grants. So if there's opportunities you know of, just send them to the officers, you know, George, Jeff, myself. I'll let Jeff talk more about scheduling, because the vice president's job is to schedule events. So people can schedule, they can go to Night Sky Network and put in requests or email Jeff directly at the VP at Back Bay Astro. Or do you have anything more to add to that, Jeff?
That's right.
Rich, if they go to the website, there's a link under the events, and one of the subtitles says requesting an event. It'll take you right to the Night Sky Network. And that's what, if someone asks me on Facebook, I direct them there, because that way all the information goes to Jeff that he needs. It prompts you for what we need to know, essentially, on that form. That is the best way, is to direct them to our website, click the events, and it says request an event. It'll take you right to the next step.
Okay, any other questions? Do we have a motion to accept the treasurer's report?
Move the motion to accept the treasurer's report.
Second.
It has been moved and seconded. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Better.
It has been accepted. All right. Secretary's report. Well, the secretary is not here.
I make a motion that we dispense the reading of the minutes.
Well, we can't read the minutes because the minutes are not here.
Even better.
I don't want to go to the website and get them.
Motion that nobody else looks them up and reads them.
So that's the secretary's report. We did have a meeting last month, and we gave away a telescope, and I don't remember the guy's name. I delivered the telescope the very next day, went to his house, and he was very appreciative, and he signed up to join the club there on the spot. So that's one of our new members. I hope you send his packet out to him, Rich.
Sure did.
Okay. All right. Alcor report. Bruce Powers.
Hello. Can everybody hear me?
Yes.
Okay, I apologize not being able to be with all of you this evening. I am getting over the sore throat that's going around. So my apologies. I'll try to be in person next month. Okay, so as we discussed earlier this year, the Reflector magazine is something everybody receives as a member of the club. We've been pretty short on observing awards. In March, you know, there were none again. So I'm pursuing my own project to try to lead by example for globular clusters. But I wanted to start at this meeting to highlight for people that aren't familiar with the Astronomical League what like one or two simple observing programs encompass. So you don't need a giant observatory or telescope to do this work. Okay, so I'm going to share a little bit here. Yes. Sure. Okay. Can everybody see my screen?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So this is the top page to the Astronomical League, and basically it's astroleague.org. And so if you go to over here on the left, okay, on the left-hand side here, you'll scroll down to a link called Observing Programs, okay? And there's lots of them. Please don't be intimidated by some of the titles of some of these. I'm going to hit two really easy ones tonight. Okay. If you go over here to observing programs A through C, you'll find the binocular double star observing program. So all you need to do this program is binoculars. Okay. Some of these programs have a book that you can order from the Astronomical League that have lists of objects. Okay. What this one in particular does is it has a, let's see. What you can do is download the list of objects directly off the website. Okay. So here's all the double stars that are sufficiently bright that you can find it from most observing locations and be able to find it with just your regular old binoculars. Okay. So, again, you don't need a giant telescope to do this. Let me get back to where I was here. Hold on. Okay. So, there's the observing list and how each of these programs is set up. Here are the observation requirements over here. Okay. Here are your submission requirements and the binocular double star observing program coordinator is who gets all your logs. So in, with this particular one, there's 120 of these binocular double stars you can find, and you just need to log 50 of them. And this webpage describes how you log all of your different objects and then submit your stuff for certification. So I want to, continue, the policy change we had during the pandemic and not making me the middleman. Okay. Unless you're under 18, I trust you that you're going to, do a good effort and submit these things, to the, program coordinator. So if you're under 18, then I'll look at it first. Anyhow, you don't need to go through me anymore. We've had a couple of people over the past 5 years submit directly to the league and it works very well. Okay. So that's the, briefly, the binocular double star observing program. Then here's one for this. It's for kids, the Sky Puppy Observing Program. Okay. And it's, again, does not require a telescope. To qualify for this, you have to be under 10 years old. And all the child has to do is basically locate 15 constellations, make sketches of them, and find some things inside them. And then, again, they submit everything to the program coordinator listed here.
Hey, Bruce?
So, yep.
Our club had either the first or one of the first five Sky Puppy Awards. Cliff Hedgepeth's granddaughter, her name just slipped my mind. She was our Sky Puppy. She joined when she was about 10 years old, and she got that award, one of the first ones to ever get that award.
Right. Okay. So, yeah. Anyhow, when you're done with all this, I'll stop sharing now. You get a cool pin, okay? And you can put it on your Star Party name tag, okay? And all your Star Party attendee friends will be impressed by how much flair you have. Okay. So anyway.
You're blinging, Bruce.
I am blinging.
You're like ready for the club, man. You just like in the VIP for us.
Well, I saw other people doing this at the Staunton River Star Party. These are my Staunton River tags. So I figured I'd do the same thing. So anyhow, it's basically merit badges for adults, but it does require some effort and time. You're not going to be able to finish one of these things in a day or a week. I'm convinced that globular clusters is going to take me the next 3 years because I can only find stuff during the summer. Anywho, so that is my Alcor report.
Okay, thank you very much. Regarding those pins, I used to put them on my hat. I had about half a dozen pins on my hat, but then I'd be out at night observing and I'd lose the pin somewhere in the dark, and I didn't realize it till I got home the next day. And so I don't put pins on my hat anymore, but I like them on that lanyard. That's good.
Taylor Christie was her name.
Taylor Christie, yes, Taylor Christie was Cliff Hedgepeth's granddaughter.
If you do the award, you get put on the website.
Yes, your name gets on the Astronomical League website. So if you want to go to an award, see who got that award, you can find out who it was. Okay, next presentation is the scholarship chairman. Ben, would you like to come up here and tell us about what's going on with the scholarship?
Okay, so never miss an opportunity to ask for money too. So if you, welcome to the club, new members. We have saw some new folks here. The club offers two scholarships, a $1,500 scholarship from the Back Bay Amateur Astronomers, as well as a $1,000 scholarship from the Georgie June Memorial Scholarship. Great person, was part of our organization for many years and just gave so much to our club. Sadly, we lost her too early, and we memorialized her with a scholarship fund for that, and that's $1,000. So we go out and solicit throughout Hampton Roads to the schools. They post it up on their sites. The students apply. It requires a combination of ACT, SAT scores, their GPA, 500-word essay, as well as a teacher's recommendation. And then we get those in and compile them. And then around the summer time frame, we award them their scholarships. They come to the meeting and present it. And we also read their essay, which is kind of fabulously fun to read. It's really interesting, all the research and things they do at an amazingly young age. So right now, the packages are due May 1st. So I checked the post office. We have a handful of those that have come in. Matt's on the committee, George on the committee, and we'll be reviewing those. I'm going to check it again, give some time just in case the postmark date and they came in late, and get some more. Then we rank them, stack them, score them, and then evaluate them, the members of the scholarship committee, and then we award the prize. So it's a great program for our size organization. The fact that we're giving away $2,500 of scholarship money every year, and now we've done that for several years now, is an amazing amount of money for our size club. And I'm a member of other clubs and stuff like that. So true testament to, you know, the great things we do as an organization of outreach and scholarship. So
yeah. I have a question. Yeah. Is there a possibility we can increase the amount of the scholarships?
The amount increases, it typically is kind of a pain threshold. We work with the treasurer. Where's our treasurer? Up there somewhere, there's Richard. We check with him and see how things are going. So we set the fund for the following year around the winter time frame. And depending on how much money we have, we can tweak those. So we, you know, like to be conservative and make sure we can pay for it. That's very important. So we don't have to draw from the regular funds, but we have fundraisers, donation, because we are a 501(c) organization. It's a non-for-profit education. You can, anything you donate is tax deductible right off the top. So, or on the bottom. Not off the top, you're right. It's before the, above the line. So you're welcome to donate. Please do. Encourage the employer to donate if they look for opportunities to support the not-for-profit. We have great outreaches. So it's a great, great program. And we've given away thousands, over $10,000 for the scholarships over the years. So, all right.
Thank you, Ben. Yes, I give a modest amount monthly. It comes out of my banking online automatically. I never see it. It goes to the treasurer, and supposedly Rich takes care of it and puts it in the scholarship fund. And
tell us you're behind Rich, don't you?
Pardon? Yeah. yeah. Rich bought a telescope with it. I, as far as I know, we got about $850 out of the raffle for the telescopes.
Great.
And that went directly to the scholarship fund. So that helped greatly to bring up our Georgie June scholarship fund. Okay. Should have asked you to stay up here. Is there anything new on the RRRT, the Rapid Response Robotic Telescope?
I haven't logged into it yet. If folks don't know, the RRT, Rapid Response Robotic Telescope, is on Pound Mountain, a few hours drive from here. It's Norfolk State University, what's the university? Virginia Tech?
UVA.
It's a large telescope, about $1.2 million project up there. And our club is kind of like the designated club, and we're kind of a host for it. And we have full access to it. It's fully robotic. It's beautiful. It's large, clamshell dome. And if you're interested, on the website, get a hold of me or whatever. We'll get you a free account. You get unlimited points. They'll set you points. And then you have a planetarium web-based application. You log in, you look at the planetarium, you say, I'm going to go to the star, this planet, this area, this constellation, and you pick the filters, the time, exposures, and the number of exposures, and you can download the raw files if you're interested in processing, like in Photoshop or whatever, or it can give you a JPEG. Nice and simple. So, pretty nice.
Okay. Thank you. Next item is old business. I've got a couple things. On the apparel, we have a bunch of new shirts, different sizes, gray and light blue, but large, small, medium, extra large, maybe a couple 2XL. Sean, has the price of the t-shirts gone up?
It is going to.
Are we still charging the same amount?
It says 12 on the website, but no one's ordered a t-shirt that I know of recently, and Rich will have to change the code to reflect the prices that I gave you guys at the quote. When you use PayPal, it's like, what, $1? I have it on there, plus the price of the t-shirts is probably going to go to 15.
Okay, so what are we selling these for, 12 or 15?
Well, we bought these for 12.
So okay, so right now, the price for the t-shirts are 12. So if you want a t-shirt, you guys online, you got to come in here and get a t-shirt. Or if you tell me, send me an email, I might even mail it to you. It costs you extra. We've got t-shirts for sale. Before I forget, we got a door prize tonight. We always try to have a door prize. A month or so ago, we gave away the two volumes of Skywatching by David Levy. And this month, we have Advanced Skywatching, also by David Levy, Robert Burnham, Alan Dyer, Robert Garfinkel, Martin George, and Jeff Knight. And somebody needs to mute their microphone. So at the end of the meeting, those of us who are present, those of you who are online, I'm sorry, you don't get a ticket. Has everybody got a red ticket?
Yes.
Okay, good. Has everybody signed the sign-in sheet?
Yes.
Good.
I get to win the regular one before I can win the advanced one anyway.
I gave away the regular one already. Gave that away last month or the month before. Okay.
So you're obligating me. You win the advanced one, you got to go buy the first one. You're like skipping steps here.
You should already be advanced, Rich. What's that?
Doesn't mean I am.
Okay. Next item. Eclipse glasses. We have over, 2,000? 5,000 Eclipse glasses. Getting ready for the 2024 Eclipse on April the 8th. So I meant to bring my box of glasses tonight, and I forgot.
But,
you can get glasses that we're going to sell them for $2 a piece.
Please sell them. We've already paid for them all. That was a huge amount of money.
Yes, there's a lot of money. We paid for them, so now we got to sell them in advance of the eclipse in 2024. So, I also noticed we do have an event that was requested talking about the eclipse. It's scheduled for the October the 10th for, I can't remember who it was. But
that was a lady out at Pass Break,
Cortland. Yeah, Cortland. And they bought 2,000 eclipse glasses, and they're going to give them away. So they're cutting into our profit there. Anyway, but that's we'll be attending that.
Now that's for the annular eclipse. It's going to be partial here.
Right. Well, yeah.
So you really need glasses to see it.
Yeah. For the annular eclipse coming up, if you go out to the west. Out to Texas or Nevada or no. The annual eclipse comes through. It doesn't hit very many large cities. It hits Albuquerque and San Antonio. Those are the only two large cities it hits. But it comes diagonally from the northwest through the goes out through Texas. But for that, it's an annular eclipse, which means the sun never goes away. You'll see a ring around the moon, the black moon, and you cannot view it without glasses. They warn you, don't take your glasses off to see the annular eclipse. But in 2024, we'll have a total solar eclipse, and it's going to be going diagonally from Texas up through New England, and we'll have people going all over the country to see that. Indiana, Ohio, Texas, so forth. The Kentucky. Hotels
have jacked their prices up like crazy, like 5x.
Oh, I meant to get my reservation in.
Five times more.
I meant to get mine in. I haven't done it yet. I better do it. Okay. Old business. Any old business? Any other old business? Any new business?
I got a quick announcement.
Okay.
I wish she was here tonight. Sam Bartholomew and I were finally appointed the solar, not the solar system, the solar eclipse ambassadors as part of the club and as, for the whole United States. So that's pretty good too.
Wow.
And so I'm really proud of her. And so I'm going to go through the training and then I'll be an expert on solar eclipses.
Wonderful.
Thanks.
Very good. There you go.
Okay. Any more new business? That's good. Any observing reports? What have you seen lately? Anybody online or anybody in here that has something you've seen that you want to tell us about? Jeff.
You mentioned that, not to toot my own horn, but Sean is the expert at finding Venus in the daytime. He finds it every time. Every day we go out there with an event, He always finds it before I do too. I'm kind of jealous. So
Sean is the Venus finder.
I didn't realize. I mean, even if it's a really, really bright day, Venus is up there, and so it's not that bright when it's waxing. It was impressive. So hats off to Sean and for all the events, and that's a big hit during the day to not only see the sun. Solar filters, but see Venus in the daytime.
Okay, thank you. Any other observing reports? Yes, Bill Rust.
I wouldn't call it observation. I have I discovered a new way to align a telescope without using the old-fashioned grip. And I wrote a paper on this.
Good. All right. Good for you. Bill's going to give a presentation on his new method of lining a telescope. Going out to California. Wow. Good. Anybody else with an observing report? Okay, well, we will go into our...
Yeah, meeting. Bruce Petkolansky.
Oh, Bruce, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, Bruce.
Go ahead, Bruce.
You're muted.
You're on mute.
Okay, so, I saw lots of cool stuff at the Stunt River Star Party, but I already yakked about that last month. So, I don't know if we had any, shameless plugs for... Sean Lozier's most awesome ECSP home site, but here it is again. So kudos again to Sean Lozier for building this. So be sure to check out the East Coast Star Party. And then May 15th through the 18th, I'm headed up to DC for this Humans to Mars Summit. I may do a presentation on it later this year. But it's a nonprofit that I support that basically advocates, landing humans on Mars by the mid 2030s. So they got lots of, interesting speakers. And I go to this in DC every year. So anyway, looks like fun. That's it.
Very good. Thank you, Bruce. Oh, I forgot to mention, as far as observing reports, several of us went out to, what was the name of that park? Dowdy Park in Nag's Head, just the first part of this month, or no, last part of April, and had nice clear skies and about 250 people looked through our telescope. We had about five or six telescopes there. Jeff was there, Sean was there, Roland Downing, Jeff Thornton.
Well, we did see the day old moon.
And we saw the 1 day old moon, which is unusual because it's very hard. It's a very thin crescent, but it was there. It was visible. And of course, we saw Venus, Mars, and had a great time and wonderful night of observing. Okay, one of my objectives as president for this new year, and I haven't really stated it, but in my mind I want to have more presentations from our own members. We've had other people come in and give talks, and we've had other things, but some of our members do some really awesome and interesting things. We've had in January, Dan Pelzel talked to us about how he does photo imaging, processing, astro imaging. We had a planetarium show from our member, Leah Flax, who's also our faculty sponsor here. Jeff gave a great presentation on celestial navigation. And there was one other one. It escapes my mind. Yes. Marcos gave his presentation on his meteorite collection and general information about meteorites. So this month, we've got another one of our members, a longtime member, also our scholarship chairman, Ben Loyola, is going to give us a presentation. Several years ago, he built a house, and as part of his house, he built an observatory, and he has built several observatories. Ben is a retired naval captain. He went to the U.S. Naval Academy, got an engineering degree, served 30 years in the Navy, retired as a captain in 2013. He had been flying A6 intruders, landing on aircraft carrier. And since he's been in the civilian world, he's an entrepreneur. He's established an engineering firm, and he has worked for the Navy for some things and done some other things. He's built several observatories, 5 observatories, in fact, one of which is his own. He's also a scholarship chairman, as you know. So I'm going to have Ben come up now and tell us about his observatory.
Well, twisted my arm, George. I wanted to see this thing, huh? All right, what are we going to do here? How do you share this screen?
Just click on the green thing at the bottom.
Green button at the bottom.
What? We gotta get this thing full circle. Wait, oh, escape. Zoom. Zoom. Share screen. And we want to do this guy right here. Share that. All right. And then get into the presentation mode.
Do you have any sound?
Oh. There you go. Does that work? Someone give a thumbs up?
Yep, yeah, looks good. Looks good.
Cool. Let's change that to group. Let's see.
Now I'm getting school.
There, wait. Show grid video. That's not what I want. I want to show. I want to get minimize that. That's what I want to do.
Hide.
There you go.
All right, that works. All right, cool. Okay. So start off, one of the most important things, once you do get home observatory, you do need those Latin longs. It goes in every software application that you use. So real good GPS system, and get as precise as possible, and the altitude as well. It all goes in the atmospheric calculation, stuff like that. But I wanted an observatory. My wife wanted a house, so don't tell her that. I built a big observatory. So this was the original design, which became reality. Typical roll-off roof observatory where you have a scope come down. And the issue is, if you want to look down low on the horizon, if you don't have a lift system, you'll be cutting off part of the sky all the way around. So the scope sits on top of the lift with a split roll-off. I didn't want the sheet hanging way off the outside. So it's actually split roof, and you'll see that in a second, right above the bathroom, right above the kitchen. So it's up there in the sky. This was the construction of the house. The telescope sits on a beam that crosses here. This is poured concrete, 8 inches here, and it goes across this upper area. And this is the beam that sits upon it. It's 16 by 16 wow. inches, full of rebar, full of concrete, 5,000 PSI concrete, nice and sturdy, no vibrations. It doesn't go anywhere, and that's good. And then the floor floats around it, so there's no vibration involved on that. That's the beam after it's been unwrapped and ready to put some drywall and put a roof and those kind of things on there. And that's, it sits right on top of the bump out there, which sits above the breakfast nook and things like that. So a little more detail. So now So now you got the facility. Now let's go through the long and arduous process of doing installing and creating a fully robotic observatory with all the challenges, and there are lots of them. So first thing here is obviously we needed to hammer drill in some thing to create a more of a pedestal and then build a box around it with some rebar and some wire to allow it to get to the right height. And it came out pretty nice, carpeted. It's nice to be able to walk around at night and not hurt yourself. So everything's all carpeted and soft and comfy, as well as keep the sweat and humidity and all the dew and stuff like that from building. That on top of it is a PureTech lift. This goes up about 20 inches and the telescope sits atop of it. It's robotic as well as local control. It has a little controller hanging off here, and you can do it when you're visually, you can tweak all you want up and down a little bit, as well as when you're robotic using the software, depending on where the planet, the stars, whatever, you can adjust the height and put it. Also, it's used when I'm tucking down and the winds are starting to pick up, because otherwise you get the vibration. So you're able to really adjust it quite a bit for either visual or imaging features. It's a great platform. PureTech lift. Can't say enough good things about it. This is the roll off. You can see the railings here. This is like kind of like a pickup truck roller bearings, four of those, and then the sits on top of the observatory, and that's kind of half of it. Designed it pretty thick aluminum. You can see the gauge on there. It's pretty thick, and it's held up, and it doesn't leak. It overlaps about 9 inches when it's closed, so no water comes in. It's got a kind of a weather strip also as well to keep the rain. I've never had any problems on it. The biggest challenge I've had, I will tell you this, because it's metal, is when you have the temperature inversion situation, it starts to rain in your observatory. Reminded me of the blimp stations down in Elizabeth City. They used to have their own atmosphere. So this gets covered in that. And about two years ago now, heat stripped this. So now it's got an automatic heat strip. So as soon as the temperature drops down, it doesn't do up anymore, because it would get the start dripping on everything, my papers and drawings and telescope, and didn't like that. So now it works. Little heat strip, it's just a peel and stick, and has a little thermostat that's glued to the metal. And once it hits the right temperature, it starts heating up. It's about 150 watts. Does a pretty good job and keeps the dew off on the inside. This is a mechanism here. Little electric motor before all the wiring gets in, but the cable system, it was quite mental gymnastics trying to figure out how to get one going one direction and the gearing and the ratios and get the timing, because one's longer than the other one's ratio. And every one of these little cams, and these were machined, and I actually went to sprockets and had to get the right number of teeth on sprocket to get it to go maximum opening as well as closing properly and tight it against the weather seal. So that was fun with limit switches and stuff. So you end up spending, you know, once you have an observatory, you never stop working, tweaking, adjusting, as you know, astronomy, not much less your telescope, all the other stuff that goes along with it. So, but that ended up working good. Of course, you had to have your own control panel to do that. So inside the telescope, astrophysics, I actually purchased that from Bruce Bodner, our old member. I haven't seen him in a while. He was an eye doctor.
He's got bad back problems.
Yeah.
Lift those scopes anymore.
Yeah, he sold me as a beautiful astrophysics 1200 mount. It is beefy. It is awesome. The way the mount's almost 100 pounds by itself. And that's what sits on top of the PureTech lift. It's equatorial, as you can see. So you've got the shaft, the right ascension and declination shafts there. And it's just a fantastic mount. It's a beast. I have now that's covered. How do you do full screen? Do you do that? It's a Celestron C14 is what I have now. The Schmidt cast grain, if you don't know, Schmidt cast grain has a whole bunch of optics here. The light comes through here through a corrector plate that covers the whole intake of the telescope. And then it bounces off the rear cell here, which is the main cell, then bounces off this one, which here shows the attach, but it's actually not. It has three adjustment screws to adjust the depth as well as the alignment here, and then goes to your optics, eyepiece or whatever, or camera or CCD. So all this has to be collimated and gotten pretty accurately and pretty exact to get the most out of your telescope. You know, it comes from factory, but imagine it bounces around pickup trucks and, you know, flatbed trucks, and finally goes up to a few stories and finally gets mounted and box gets open. So there's a lot of optics, lots of screws, and you want to laser line all that to get it just right so that everything that comes in here bounces, it comes back. So now you got your telescope, but we're not done yet. So we got an observatory, we got a telescope, we got a mount. Not done yet. So here's some of the issues. All telescopes have this stuff, really. Reflections internally. They come from factory with not the best black finish on the inside. And I'll go through some of that. You saw that big Hunker mirror on the backside. So you have mirror flop, depending on where it's looking in the sky. Cooling that mirror, you have the backlash in the gears. You have the periodic error on the worm gear, the primary worm gear, both right ascension and declination, but mostly right ascension. And then the polar alignment, orthogonality, as well as pointing and tracking. All these issues have to be addressed one at a time, tweaked so that you can truly have a robotic telescope.
So you called an engineering firm, right?
Yeah. Loyola Enterprises. Loyola Enterprises, yes. And my good friend, he hasn't seen him in a while. Yeah, Kevin, he's been,
Kevin,
I know, yeah, Kevin Weiner and his wife, but he's been out for a while. He's out in Chesapeake and stuff like that. But he came over, this is my C11 one time, and I'll show you the difference and the importance of that internal reflections. So they paint all telescopes with black paint, but you buy this paper called flock paper, and it's a fuzzy black, and you can see the difference. So again, our mission, astronomers, is get every photon that's coming through and eventually hitting the front of your telescope and get into your eyeball or your camera, one or the other. And one of those important issues is signal to noise. So the signal is the photons coming in, the noise is everything else is trying to detract from that. So you can imagine here, you can see the light reflecting here on the black paint originally from factory and how pretty much white. So you imagine street lights and ambient light reflected off the city, off the clouds, and just off the atmospheric humidity is reflecting that light throughout what you're viewing. And that's bouncing around the sides, eventually working its way into the optical train and lowering your contrast. Basically, it's affecting the contrast of your visual or your CCD. So you can go online and buy this in a roll, and it's sticky. So you got to take your time, be prepared, be patient. Even if you have to do it in little strips, it doesn't worry. I was able to get the whole roll in there just right, fit it right, and with the help of Kevin. But you can see the difference. And that's just the same camera, same picture, bam, bam. It's just pitch black. And it truly does help your contrast ratio in your eyepiece or your camera. It just gives you a better, richer feel. That's the best way I can say it. So now we've got the reflections taken care of. Let's continue on. The other aspect of reflection is on the end of the telescope, and this has that big corrector plate on a Schmidt-Cassegrain, is you want to stop the reflections coming off, and this is a dew shield, as well as preventing those reflections from coming in and bouncing. So that's that kind of same flat paper and absorbs it to keep it coming down to the other end. So that was my old C11 there on top of the astrophysics and the roll-off roof there. And that worked pretty good. So here's some other issues here. So what happens in the Schmidt-Cassegrain, you have the secondary, which sits on top of a kind of a gimbal mount with three screws here, and that light comes in here through the corrector plate, which has to be aligned and adjusted perfectly and parallel. It bounces off this big whopping mirror. This sits on a tube with this thick grease. It's like thick grease. I mean, it's thick, real thick. Biggest grease I've ever seen on this tube, and you can see, so it's kind of a big weight on a thick tube hanging out here, and you have this moment arm. And so as the telescope is moving and imaging, it flops. It literally just flops ever so infinitesimal, but it flops. So originally people came up with all sorts of contraptions, and I did too, trying to address it. So you literally drill into the back of your telescope and put an all thread in here and then tap it. And then all of a sudden now you have these shafts, which go up and rest and have a little, you dip them in the rubber can that finally somewhat hardens. And it touches just ever so slightly the back of the primary cell of the glass of the primary mirror. And what that does is it keeps it from flopping. So imagine the weight's here, and then it wants to do this. It wants to flop over ever so slightly, which of course throws off your imaging, throws off your focus, does all sorts of crazy stuff. So this is a mirror lock system. And the way telescopes came earlier on, they didn't have those, at least in Schmidt-Cassegrain size from Celestron. Another issue is once you get your scope all set up is you want to check orthogonality. And what that is imagine over here, if you don't perfectly perpendicular and parallel here, you're slightly off, you flip it to the other side, and now you're on this side, and you see this gap here, and again, this is exaggerated. So what you do is you do that multiple times and you shim it. You put this thinnest material in the saddle with the telescopes bolted to the Los Mondi. And that makes sure that both on the east side and the west side of the pier of your mount, it's perfectly orthogonal. So that way when you're pointing and you're switching back, because when you're tracking, it has to flip because the counterweight will hit the pier. So equatorial mounts have that problem. So over a period of time. So when you do that and you're on the other side and you continue your imaging, and I do some really long imaging. I image Jupiter for, you know, from as soon as it comes about 8 degrees off the horizon down to 8 degrees and compile a lot of data. You want this to be as parallel and tweaked as possible. So that's another thing. And so it's a, you know, tedious process, but it makes it's an important thing to do. Of course, the classic that we all go through is a polar alignment. There's no way to get rid of that, is there? Maybe not. I don't know.
You see, try to click it off to the side. Does it make it go
work? No, I guess not. Leave me optimize here. So no. Hide floating media controls. Hey, there you go. We're called. Okay, escape to show it. All right, there you go. So your basic polar alignment, which obviously is fundamental to equatorial. There's your counterweight. Your right ascension shaft, your declination. So what you're trying to do is get the telescope to counteract the rotation of the Earth. And that requires a polar alignment. And everybody says, oh, Polaris. Well, Polaris is to the north. It's good for approximating the Mariners and heading that way when you're camping. But it's really not true north. And you can do it visually with a little telescope that slides in the hollow shaft here. Or you can do it with an imaging to get ultra precise. Of course, if you're going to do a robotic telescope, you're going to do ultra precise polar alignment. Do it once, lock the system down, and then it's going to be counteracting the rotation of the Earth as perfect as you can bet. Perfectly fine. You do that with two adjustments. One here is the altitude adjustment, and this is a screw here with a little handle, and you tweak that up, and then you lock these Allen wrenches down, and then these you turn, and it's got a slight adjustment. So you get a crudely close eyeball, and then you get this as close to center here. You get your altitude based on your latitude, about 36 degrees north, and then you start adjusting it. Your software will tell you go up, down, left, right, east, west, north, south, and you make all the adjustments, and then you go back an image, and you go back an image, and you go back an image, and after a few hours, it's like spot on.
How do you know where true north is?
You look at Polaris, and you get, if you get Polaris just visually, and then the software takes it over from there. The way you do it through the center of the optic is there's actually a diagram at the time of year where true north is in reference to Polaris. It paints the primary stars around that, around Polaris, and you tweak it, just shows the correct year, and then that's pretty accurate, good enough. But if you're doing long-term imaging and you're trying to get this thing as right as possible, really to do scientific work, you want to use the imaging process, which uses a camera and software to do a very, very accurate polar alignment. So, and it does the same thing that your eyes do it, but to much more precision. So, okay, you got your telescope mounted, it's on your lips, on your observatory, and there's a few more gears and things to take care of. Backlash. What happens inside a telescope is you have a worm gear on your right ascension. And this is pretty much spinning along, ticking along, controlled by your software, the internal brains of this stuff, based on the rotation of the Earth and counteracting that. Well, if you notice that the teeth have to mesh with this gear. Of course, it's man-made and nothing's perfect. So what happens is the mesh is not perfect. It's these teeth, you know, combine in and they're like the radio and they come in, combine in, and they have to continue to be matched perfectly. So what happens is when it reverses or does a correction or it's even pushing, that sometimes you get a little bit of movement, and that's the backlash. So you can see here, it turns the gears prior to and after commands. That's the correction. So the system learns it and programs it almost into the firmware, the built-in mechanical backlash that this has. So the little bit of flop here, and then this thrust bearing that's holding these two bearings and the servo drive that does all this, actually rotates this, it compensates for the backlash such that when it's tracking best. And then a little note there, you always want to adjust your counterweight. You don't want a perfectly balanced telescope, because why? Then this is floating. I mean, if you have a perfectly balanced telescope, then this is just kind of just right there. And the only thing it's holding is really is the grease. which, you know, the slightest wind is going to push the grease squirt out over here. This is a microscopic level. I mean, imagine being in there, you can see the actual gear. So you got heavy grease in there, and there's a little bit of play. And if the wind blows one way, it buffers, and then that's pushing on this teeth, and that's pushing on that teeth. So it moves, so everything's moving. So you want well-meshed teeth, and then you also want to institute this backlash correction and have when you're pushing from the east to the west, you want it to be slightly heavy on the eastern side. Why? You always want to ride on the side of the gear. So this gear is always pushing the telescope up. It's always spinning. This worm gear is always spinning and pushing on the gear train constantly. You don't want it to float. So a perfectly balanced telescope is not a good telescope. So a little heavy on the east side, just a little bit heavy on the east side. There you go. So we got backlash now, right? So we got mirror flop backlash. Oh, there's one more. So here's the other aspect process, the worm gear. So this worm gear, of course, man-made, is tried to be a perfect cylinder and tooth and stuff like that. It's spinning around. And what happens is, because it's not an absolute perfect, this rotates about once every 5 minutes, thereabouts. And so you start getting a periodic error. So as you're doing it, and when it's on one part of the worm, it's going faster. And then it goes another part of the worm, it's slowing down. It's still going the right direction, but slow. So you're getting this wobble effect. And that's the periodic error correction. Comes from the factory, recommend you do your own. And so there's a periodic error correction that you actually flash back to the mount's program, and it compensates for that as well. So that's just one more thing you tweak once you get everything all nice and tight and moving. See, is there anything else here?
How do you adjust for that?
Glad you asked. So let's look at the importance of it here. So imagine he's like, God, this is like really infinitesimal stuff. It is, because here's make sure everybody understands this stuff. So imagine a circle 360 degrees, right? You have stars around the world, 360 degrees. So that's 21,000 minutes. That's 1.2, 1.3 seconds. When you're imaging and you're doing really precision work, you're down in the 10th of an arc second, or about 13 million segments around a 360 degree circle, 13 million. So it's really precise stuff. So all this stuff adds in trying to get rid of as much error, as much flop, as much deviation as possible, trying to get some real good important data out of it. So what happens, this is one program, PEM Pro, PEM Pro. And what this does is, this is the actual full rotation, where is it right here? 382 seconds for one full worm period, or about, what is it? Almost 60, so it's almost about 6 minutes. Yeah, a little over 6 minutes. So every time it's rotating around, it's a little faster, a little slower, a little faster, a little slower. So this thing rotates, does multiple times, and does a fast Fourier analysis of that, and which is this next one. And that tells you that, like, in one fundamental circle of rotation, it has a tenth of an arc second of error. This is the phasing. And then in two cycles per worm, so that's every half circle, it has a much higher, interestingly enough, you see this is the engineering, you know, lathe and a machine and the polishing, has a bigger error halfway around. And then there's some other smaller ones that get less and less and less, a third of a rotation, a fourth of a rotation, that kind of stuff. So this does the analysis, it does a curve fit, and then applies that in reverse. So when it's trying to speed up, it's gonna slow down the pulses to the worm gear. When it's trying to slow down, it's going to speed up the pulses. So this is basically reverse engineering so that it does a perfectly smooth tracking. Yes, sir.
Well, it also depends on compensation.
This complicates, good question. It's the right ascension gear, which is not affected by declination. It's right ascension. So it's moving at the normal rate. Yeah. So that this is moving at the normal rate, right ascension at the normal clock speed. It's just infinitesimally accelerating, decelerating based on the actual mechanical differences on that. All right. So got that one out of the way. Let's look at pointing. So now you want to tell a telescope on your system to go to someplace. It's got to know, it doesn't know where it really is. You have to set that up unless you spend the big bucks and do optical encoders. And optical encoders are very precise. It's like you saw that 1/10 of an arc second. An optical encoder will take you to 1/100th of an arc second. So it was like over 100 million rotational increments. And that tells the telescope knows exactly where it is. And therefore, if I tell it to go point someplace, so you avoid this issue. Short of that, you have pointing errors to say, I want you to go over here. I've told you where you are, and it points over there, but there's all sorts of other things. You think this mass, the counterweights and all that stuff, and everything flexes. You know, plastic flexes, metal flexes, the stainless steel shaft flex, everything flexes ever so much. So now it's got to learn that. How do you do that? This is a program, MapPoints. And imagine you're sitting inside a planetarium, you see all the stars. Imagine there's like 200 stars. And what it does is it goes to one star and says, okay, I'm here. I think I'm pointing, I've been told to go to this position. It does a plate solve. It calculates where it actually is and then records that information. So it does this like 200 points in a whole half sphere, or as many as you want to. Basically, you go to, you can do 10, you can do 200. And then it creates a point model of where it's pointing. So when you tell it to go here, it says, oh, I know here is not here. Here is over here because I already went there. And it saves a little file on the point model. So that way now you have a very good precision. And that accounts for the flexure, the scope, and the atmospheric refraction, and all sorts of other things. Temperature, humidity, all feed in this as well to really make that point cloud very precise.
This is in your computer, and it does it every night when you set
up. So through a, I'll show you the flow through here. So through the ASCOM, when the planetarium software says go here, it goes through the point model and says here is not here. And if it's in between all the points, let's say you did 50, right? 50 scattered points or 10 scattered points, it will interpolate between the points. So it has a model, a kind of a mesh, imagine a kind of web of points, and it can interpolate between those actual physical points based on this point model. So that when it goes, it's pretty accurate. So you can see here a scatter point. These are all the scatter points here. 367 arc seconds of error. It's all over the place, right? So after the thing, it brings it down to less than 30. So like less than 1/10, which is pretty reasonable of pointing accuracy. And then after that, you still have to do a plate solve with your camera if you're doing that, which means you take the picture, it says, okay, that's where those stars are at. And now I know exactly where the telescope's called plate solve. Yeah.
Do you use like more like advanced programs or do you use like simple stuff?
These are all astronomy programs that there's shareware, there's you pay for depending on the level of use you want to have. And there's lots of pieces. You'll see the lot. Different pieces do different things. There's some all in one now. The Sky is a very capable, expensive program that does a lot of all this stuff. I'll show you.
Like NEMA or like,
what's that?
What do you use for major programs?
Coming right up. Good questions. So now we've taken care of the pointing model. So now we've taken care of all those errors on the gears, where it's going to. How am I doing on time? What time is it?
You got 30 minutes.
All right, good. So this is what the ultimate goal is. This is what happens. And I had this happen on imagery. I thought, what's wrong? Oh, mirror flop. Okay, I forgot to tighten down the mirror. And what happens is you take a picture, you're looking good on the thing, all of a sudden goes boom. It's like, what caused that? Was it wind? Was it the mirror flop? Was it the optical array on your camera? What caused that? And ultimately you want a nice tight star pattern. You don't want zigzags, you don't want streaks, any of that stuff. So that's, tracking error and stuff like that. So the goal is that if you tighten all that stuff down, of course you can't control wind. You get a buffeting wind, it's gonna throw everything off. And that's why you tuck back down like I talked about earlier with that pure lift lift. But if things are calm, and I typically don't, no more than 5 miles per hour at most, and the weather station keeps me on track on that because it really does buffet this telescope. And sometimes I'll remove the dew shield. I'll make up for the dew shield. I'll take that because it's hanging out another 2 feet in front of the telescope, the dew shield. And you can imagine that's out there plus the telescope height. And now you've got this 4 foot, 3.5 foot length image out there in like a sail, and it wants to be pushed around by the wind. So ultimately you don't want to be obviously messing up your imagery because you're imaging for several minutes and it just destroys everything. And the goal, asteroid tracking, you're trying to pick up these infinitesimal, like not this guy, the one next to it, like a 24th magnitude blip, 23rd magnitude, you're imaging that for like 5 minutes. You're just trying to pick up that little speck. Like this guy here, this guy, and some of those guys, but this is like saturated. This blows your saturation on your imaging all. So you don't want those guys. You want to be nice and dark. So that's tracking. So you got that. So, okay, we got the telescope and all the mechanics. Let's continue down. Now your optical train. Folks have used focal reducers and Barlows. You've heard of those? Focal reducer Barlows? Yeah, focal reducers. What you're trying to do is get more imaging on your CCD, and then the Barlows is more magnification. like I imaged Jupiter and I'm trying to get to like a tenth of an arc second on each pixel. So that requires no focal reducer and no magnification from a Barlow because I'm able to get a CCD camera with a small enough chip. But you can use focal reducers or the other side, Barlows, to compensate for whatever camera you do have if you're using that, or visually. If people have like one or two eyepieces, that's really all you need. You get a focal reducer on one side or you get a Barlow on the other, and now you have six, eight eyepieces because your Barlow changes your ability. But the other thing, and the reason I did this chart as a curve fit, is a Barlow might be an f3.3. Well, guess what? Depending on where you put it on distance affects the magnification. You can see that. So what's happening here, how much of a deviation. So on the ideal spot, that Barlow or that focal reducer will give you a certain magnification, but you can also play with it if you're trying to achieve a certain size of image on your pixel, on your camera. So just kind of put that out there. I know they all are stamped like a 2X Barlow, a 3X Barlow. Well, you can adjust that. You can make it do things that you want it to do. And this kind of pulls it all together. So this is a really cool software. It's free. Ron Wodarski puts it together. And he has like every telescope ever made. Automatically populates your aperture and your focal, and you can put your Barlow reducer here. And then it has probably 100 different things. Here's Jupiter. Here's, I think it's Orion. And you put all that stuff in there, and you put your camera in here. In this case, I have a 1A3 mono camera. These are the pixel size, pretty basically very tiny, 5,000 by 3,600 and 1X. And then it tells you your arc seconds per pixel. So right here, it calculates that. So you're imaging at 1/10 of an arc second for each pixel. So now you can see the importance of the accuracy of trying to control this beast that's, you know, heavy over here and swaying and being pushed in one direction and gears are spinning and all this stuff is happening, all to get hopefully that little photon to land on that CCD. On that little pixel, on that chip, so you can get some pretty nice imagery. So I use this a lot just to, I change things around. I might change the Barlow reducer. I have a couple cameras. I have a Canon as well. I have a guiding camera. So all these kind of things start to play. And you can bend this. See the bend mode? I have a whole other presentation on CCD. It's where you take all these pixels, 5,000 by 3,000, you can do 2 to 2, which means I'll divide that 2,500 pixels by 1,500 pixels. It's called binning. It's a whole other technique to put more photons on more pixels. So, okay, you got your imaging, you got your camera, now we're gonna focus it. How's that work? This is a cool thing. So this is what actually happens. So imagine this little rectangle is one pixel and the light comes in. Well, it's not a perfectly distributed. It's kind of a fuzzy little ball, you know, it's this thing. So there's no points, even though at this distance, it's like a point, but it's actually spread across, all right? So this is the full width half maximum. So it tells you that at here, you're trying to get on this as best seeing conditions as best on that one CCD chip. So it's calculating that. So the software, since it's robotic, takes this and says, okay, it's fuzzy. Oh, it's getting sharper. It's going the right same direction. Oh, it got fuzzy again. Let me go backwards. Oh, it's fuzzy. Oh, it's sharp, boom. And it's looking at this constant calculations of this full width half maximum until boom, it says, okay, now I've created a curve fit and I'm actually at the right point for focusing. And let it do its magic. It's automatic. Pull it all together. So what do we have? We got, now you can see how things get really complicated real fast. So you got your camera, you got your guider, atmospheric dispersion correction, I'll go in that a little bit as well too. Focuser, I have a temperature compensating focuser, filter wheel, dew heater, because you don't want that glass out in front will get covered in dew in a blink of an eye. It's amazing. So I have a automatic do that. The Telluride is good when you're doing visual and you need a lot of stuff when you're doing visual work as well. Astrophysics mount. When you're doing camera imaging, you want a light box to do your flats, which is one of the things that the corrections you do to a camera. It's basically a white box. I showed that too. Obviously, you have to control roll off. You have to control the PureSec lift. You got to have a power supply. You got to have the observatory camera because you're not in the observatory because I don't like to freeze or it gets cold because I go through the whole winter. I'll open it up and it might be 20 degrees outside. So as well as the mosquitoes, they'll get you. Lighting control and all that stuff. So that's it. And then all the different communications. You're talking USB, RS-232, just 12 volts, relays, and then all the com ports and IP addresses. So you're pulling all these disparate items, trying to pull it all together and talk to each other. And you got to have a software to control it. So I use a planetary software. This is one. The Sky 6 is a great all-in-one. I use another one for imaging Jupiter. Pulse Guide helps you with plate solve and go-to as well. This one, CCD software, controls the camera. This is a basic image. Here's a little dust bunny right here. It's showing it's not, something's interfering with the capture here. And then of course it's talking through this go-to pointing, which I talked to you about. It's one of the software, it's just talking. And how does it pull all this stuff together? I told you it was gonna get complicated, you're still going. Yeah. So you got the brains here, the ACP, Astronomy Control Program, and it's talking to all this stuff via USB or drivers or ASCOM control. I'll start over here. You gotta have weather station because this wind gets too high, it shuts everything down, puts the telescope home. Temperature, humidity, obviously if it starts raining and drizzling, because it might be raining here and perfectly, I've looked over here and it's all of a sudden starts raining inside the observatory. Even though I'm like, it's beautiful there, but the, you know, cloud comes over your head. So I put a rain sensor in there and shut everything down quickly. You don't want rain coming down on your stuff. Roll off control switch, the IP observatory cameras, the lighting in the observatory, dew heaters controlled there, and the light box reflects. That's on a USB switch as well. And that's when you do your imaging. All that feeds over here. Your plate solve for your imaging, your scheduler. Let's see, all this stuff. Coming over here, this is talking actually to the mount through an ASCOM. ASCOM stands for Astronomy Command Common Object Model. It's what the industry uses. And because everybody has their own drivers, it got crazy. So they came up with an ASCOM standard. And it works pretty good. And then your focusing program, I showed you that. That's talking to the moonlight focuser, as well as this temperature compensating automatically there. Your filter wheel with all the various filters. I told you I had a handheld camera, which can act as a camera as well. And then the two primary camera, as well as your guide camera, which I don't use that much. So then, okay, got that going. Almost there, almost gonna end this year. This is visual filters. So you gotta use filters, contrast boosting and light pollution and nebula filters. I can't recommend anything better than get yourself a bunch of filters because it'll make a difference for you immensely. The filters carry different aspects of what's happening, whether it be, this one takes off just the glare of the moon to do that. This one allows more nebula stuff. And really it notches out, I have a whole other presentation on filters, but it notches out various aspects of the light pollution and it does a really good job. So these are some of the ones I have there. And then you get a little more expensive and more a little sophisticated for the imaging on a CCD. And then you get into some, you know, red, green, blue on simple. I use the Johnson thing for imaging Jupiter here, which has specific frequencies. And then I had ordered this one. This is I'll show you why. This one was plus or minus 25 nanometers in width. It's almost like a band pass in the orange. It's called a narrow band. And I'm trying to minimize the atmospheric dispersion. I'll show you an image of that, of what the importance of that is. And then this one's just showing when things are really bad and you still want to image. IR is the way to go versus on the bright, because the bright's going crazy, but the near infrared is cutting through all the turbulence in the sky. And then a full black, why do I need a black, opaque, no band? Is because you on your CCD, when you do image correction, besides having a white, which is that box I showed you, you also have a black, which means no signal. And then you do some subtraction and addition, and that allows you to make pretty pictures, which we had a club member that presented on how to make pretty pictures. And that's important. All right. Not there yet. So you got your camera already loaded up. Your telescope's good. You got it all tweaked up. It's like, all right, open up the observatory and it looks like garbage. What happened? Well, what's happening? This is happening, a boundary layer. So you open up your observatory. Let's say the telescope was at 73 degrees, you know, home temperature. And now it's nighttime and the temperature's dropping down. It might be 50, it might be 65, whatever. So you have this boundary layer stuck to this hunkin' big piece of 14-inch glass, about an inch and a half thick, and it's creating this mess of eddy currents and stuff like that. So people have come up, it's like, you know, tube currents kill seeing because you got this eddy current. It's almost like your image is on fire, and literally it's like it's boiling in the eyepiece, and you see that. You got to let it cool down. You got to get rid of this boundary layer. You got to get the temperature equalized. So people put, here's a dot or a Newtonian reflector, and you put a little PC fan. And that's exactly what I did. This is a telescope right here. So what do? You gotta be brave, but you take a hole saw. And at that time, they didn't have it. And so you had to. You just had to. I mean, you got this big hunking pipe, and it's carbon fiber in essence. So it's like perfectly sealed. And it's like, wait a minute, how am I gonna cool this beast down? I got a piece of glass in there, and this is starting to get cold. And now I'm getting eddy currents, and it's on fire for an hour and a half. And I'm wasting observing time. And the beauty thing about observatory is like you push the button, and you know when you do that, and you go observe, and you're very efficient observing. So here's a little muffin fan. You drill the hole here, drill the hole for the on-off switch. run the wires behind the mirror here, and it'll make sure it filters, because I've had spiders walk themselves home and create a little nest in here. It's amazing. I look and say, what in the world is all this speckling? Like, I look in the front of the telescope, I was like, it's a spider. You know, spiders and babies. So, yeah, make sure you put your filters on there. And that worked great. You know, seal it, and you turn it on, knocks it down like less than half the time. Yeah, it's about 15, 20 minutes, you're good to go. That was my C11. Celestron finally got it right, and but not all the way right. They gave you these little oval vent holes on the new models. So the vent holes, that's the back of the actual mirror and the spider that holds the mirror right there, two little screws, and there's one on the opposite side. So off to the 3D printer, make a little mount that's perfectly the right curvature, little muffin fan, and that sits back in there, and the other one points in the opposite direction, creating a swirling pattern. Break that boundary layer off the face of that mirror as quick as possible, and right off the bat, even if it's not thermally stabilized, because you're swirling it and it's creating a centrifugal force, it's flattening out that eddy bubbling current, and you're basically saying, I want you to be perfectly tornado in there, and you're creating a tornado to allow everything. And you can see it works excellent. It works excellent. All you're doing is throwing the whole air column inside your telescope into the circular motion as quickly as possible to shear off that slowly moving eddy that you saw, that boundary layer. You want to break the boundary layer. And it works. On off switch and off to the races, and you're able to image. Not a problem. Okay, so we got that. We got a telescope, visual bullet. You go and look and say, okay, Jupiter's really low, or Venus or Mercury or somebody else is really low. I want to image it. And bam, what happens? Well, you got this beautiful image that the sun's out here, is reflecting off, in this case, Saturn, is coming through the atmosphere, and like, boom. What do you see? You see this blue up here. You see the green and blue all split apart, the red. You take a picture of it, it's like, God, muddy. It's muddy. So what happens is the atmosphere is creating a prismatic effect called atmospheric dispersion. And in essence, your pictures, this is exaggerated, but depending how low it is, it's not so exaggerated. You get the spreading of the colors. So how do you fix that? Voila. I'll show you actually what happens. Here's Jupiter, and I'm not sure how well it's coming through the web on the web, but this is probably the best thing. You can see here, this is without a ADC used, and this is with, and this is pretty high up actually. It's much more significant lower down. I imaged down 8 degrees. You can see kind of the details here. See how much sharper it is down here, and see some of the fingers and different features. And what you try to do, I do impact detection on Jupiter. You want to pick up the slightest blip on this stuff. So it's got to be as good as possible, because it will spread everything. It will spread, a blue filter will spread, because it's the whole spectrum. So you're taking a picture of blue, red, green, but within the blue, you have a range of frequencies of light. And so even within the blue, even between all these different colors, it's spreading. It's spreading it apart because of the atmospheric dispersion. So you still want to correct for it, even though you're doing monochromatic, even especially black and white. So you say, okay, I'm going to go out and get yourself a ZW atmospheric dispersion corrector. Anybody see a problem with this thing? It works great, but any ideas? Come on, somebody's like, what do you think is the problem with that?
Fit into your eyepiece.
If it's in your eyepiece and the camera sits on the other side, or your eyeball sits on the other side. So what happens is there's two little prisms in there, and you're supposed to counter it based on the elevation of your image, whether it be visual or on your CCD camera. See a problem with that? The issue is these little screws control the prisms on each side. So you got to tweak this one, tweak that, tweak this one. So as soon as your finger touches telescope, there goes your picture. I mean, you cannot touch your telescope, as you know. I mean, you touch it with an eyepiece trying to focus, So this is dysfunctional. So back to the printer, back to the drawing board, and voila. So what did you do? So go to the 3D printer, do a couple of servo drives, very precision servo drives with a little voltage corrector and a little microprocessor in there. Has a little script program, USB, little USB connection, and voila. And so as the telescope changes in altitude, I've programmed a script in there, and it will slowly, ever so infinitesimal, can't even tell on the imagery. It just moves these levers ever so slightly, and therefore does all the corrections. So if you did it with your finger and just move one, it'd be off your screen. You would take 5 minutes trying to find Jupiter again. I'm telling you, it's that crazy. That's how off it is. But by doing it this way, doing one and the other at the same time, and getting the programming correctly just right, it works like a champ. I should box it up.
Rube Goldberg.
But it works great. Okay, so we're almost there and we're doing good on time. So I'm almost close to wrapping up. So then you say, okay, do you have a home observatory? Do you have a portable observatory? Whatever. All right, some basic guidelines. Best to do imaging when objects are high in the sky. Why? That atmospheric dispersion. If you have all this gear and all this stuff you've done, get it as high so that the column of atmosphere above you is as small as possible. Close to the sea because you don't want that turbulence. And as high in altitude as you can, like Fan Mountains up at 3,800 feet, out further out in the western part of Virginia up at 5,200 feet. And you know, of course, you go down south in South America, of course, they've got them in Hawaii at 10,000, 12,000, 15,000 feet. You can't even breathe up there. So then why? Because you're getting rid of the atmosphere. And of course, stay away from heat sources. What do? We roll out our telescope from our garage or from our bedroom. You take it outside, you put it on the asphalt outside your house, and you say, why does it look so horrible in there? And you got all this stuff happening, you know, the asphalt and the concrete is boiling and you're trying to observe with it. It's just, everything's out to get you. Everything's out to get you and deny you the use of those beautiful photons. So just a little observing location guidance there. And then ultimately, no matter what you do, even with all this stuff and all this prep and all this determination is, seeing conditions will nail you no matter what you do. And you just can't control that. That's really the turbulence in the sky, the humidity, and what's happening in the high altitude. There's some websites that I go to first. And if it doesn't look bad, I mean, it looks bad, I won't even image because they're tracking the upper atmosphere jet streams and the turbulence, as well as the clouds up there, the cirrus clouds at the high altitude. And if they're over the top of you, you're not going to get much. You know, it's just going to be too bad. And you can see here, you know, good seeing, and we don't have good seeing here in Virginia Beach, you know, 0.3 arc seconds. Well, you're imaging at 0.1 arc seconds and you're correcting below that. So you can see how, you know, it starts really affecting it, especially when you're around us, like three seconds of bad seeing. So you're really moving across a pixel and a half, 2 pixels. It just gets muddy. So, okay, we accept whatever we got. We can't control Virginia Beach. That's your house. You got the location. You got everything all tweaked up. And this is my desktop. It's planetarium going on here. I use Fire Capture for imaging Jupiter. Works really well. It talks to the cameras. And I just run a script here. This one has 120, a loop of 120. You probably can't read that. And all it does is capture 60 seconds in a video, 60 second packets of video for 120 loops. So that's about 2 hours. I go to 240. I just let it run. And then at the end, I run the script to close it and basically shuts everything down, lowers the telescope, parks the telescope, closes the dome. And hopefully when I wake up next day, I don't have a flood in my observatory and otherwise it'd be dripping on me in the bedroom. So it works really well. This is the APCC, is the astrophysics control. This does the go-to model. This does the parking and basically controls the ASCOM, that standard communication with all the stuff. And I have to have a camera to keep an eye on things. And that's pitch black in there, so it works really well. And this is the image, my actual imaging train. I like ZWO, the price is really awesome. This is my main imaging camera, the 183, and it's a cooled system. So it's got its own power supply and then USB, and has a built-in hub. So it actually has enough power to control the filter wheel here. This is the guiding camera here. And then this is the focuser, and it's a temperature compensating focuser. So automatically you program it over a period of nights. And it says at this temperature, because everything's locked down, it will move to this location. At this temperature, it moves to this location because everything's adjusting, expanding and contracting, depending on what's happening with the temperature. And here's that one of the muffin fans here. The other one's on the other side over there too. I found that instead of letting air come in and out, it was more effective just to seal it. So this is my little rubber, but it's like I sealed the cover because all I want it to swirl and it works great. And just let it cool down however it wants to cool down. I just want to rip that boundary layer off the face of the mirror. So that's that. Yep, let's see what else we got. And there's the whole picture. So this is a 4-point laser alignment system. I've aligned this thing and I keep aligning. You get fanatical. I mean, you get stuck on this thing. I'm gonna get it perfect. And you just do it again and again. So this projects four laser points. You can see the points on that into the scope, and you gotta adjust the primary mirror, the corrector plate, as well as the secondary, all in there. So everything comes out in line and this long imaging trail on the backside. This is the light box I was telling you about. It's got a USB switch, a little USB cable here. And all it is it's that foam board and Christmas tree lights. And it's behind a baffle and then two layers of translucent plastic white. And that is the flat. So the telescope can be programmed both right ascension declination or azimuth and elevation. So the first thing it does, it goes azimuth and elevation down low, takes a picture of that. That's my flat, takes a series of those, and then goes back to the right ascension declination to where all the stars or planets, whatever it is right there. And that's pretty much it on that. Yeah, we're doing good. It is in dark mode. UPS, power supply, bug zapper, weather station, dome controller, manual override. Of course, there's USB and fiber optics back that way to the other side of the house. That's the peer tech lift I told you about, the imaging, and that's pretty much it. Let's see what I got. So this is, let's see if this works. This is a, hey, it works. So I've had difficulty closing it sometimes because of stalactites or whatever, ice crystals, and they formed on the outside of the dome. And I'm like, why will it not close? What's happening here? And literally here go, coom, 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 as it's shearing off the crystals off all, and there's all the tape. Remember the tape I told you about, the heat strip? Yeah, that's why I added it. There you go. That's the limit switch thing. Okay, I hit the limit switch. So that's that. Let's see how I already did that part. How do I get to the next one? Oh, here we go. So this is the PureTech lift. And this is normally scripted. So it would do all this automatically. It would open up, has limit switches on open and close. And then it just goes up to the full extent up. That's the actual astrophysics hand controller for if you're doing visual stuff. And that PureTech is really nice. You can imagine you're over here and then you go to another star and you're down here. It's like, oh, bring it up a little bit. Because it, you know, being comfortable is a thing you want when you're observing. Otherwise, your body will give out well before, obviously, the sky will. So having that, and then, you know, ladder, depending on what you're trying to do, if you're way down low, getting up to it, go. This is a little custom box I made here for the power supplies, 12-volt, 5-volt controllers, or so step-down voltage controllers there, depending on what I'm doing. Because I've got dew heater controls, and I have a digital temperature controller on that. You just tinker forever. If you get a home observatory, if people have ever had one, it just keeps going. So that's pretty much it there. And then, and voila, there you go. You're ready for observe. That's the way it goes. That's pretty much it. And that's a little temperature controller, which I set it just about two and a half degrees above the ambient dew temperature. So the only, what you don't want is the superheat. People have a manual control dew heater. And the problem is it sends so much electricity and voltage to the heating strip, it overheats it. So now you have these eddy currents coming off your dew heater strips, which is now you're exacerbating. Yeah, you've got the dew off, but now you've got all these eddy currents on top of your scope and imaging. So this allows it to be controlled. That was about that cheap and worked really well, a lot better than the ones you buy from the places. So that's pretty much it. I think that is it.
Yep. Wow. Yeah.
3 minutes to spare. All right. You forced me. All good.
Sharing this stop. Okay. Thank you, Ben. All right. Wow.
That's a great presentation. Any questions?
I do have one.
Yeah.
So you're doing one image with long exposure.
Yes and yes, depending on what you're doing. So like my image Jupiter, I'm videotaping.
Okay, and then
so I'm doing about 30 frames a second for like 7 hours. Yeah, so as much as I can get it, and the weather permitting and all that good stuff. So so I image Jupiter as much as I can because we're doing persistent impact detection, which is a kind of global project. Mm-hmm. Dr. Saganami from Hampton University. And you could do that. You could do that with a handheld camera. I have a presentation. That's on our website, by the way. Jupiter Impact Detection Program is on the BBA website. So you can do that with your handheld phone, binoculars. I mean, it all works because Jupiter's so bright and so big. Yeah. And we try impact detection. It's part of our planetary defense system, which actually feeds NASA and all the efforts for planetary defense. Because you have to pray for asteroids and solar flares because against them. Because that's the thing.
Solar flares are kind of.
Yeah, big time. Yeah. And so if you're taking imagery, like our other class member, which specializes in beautiful pictures, you're taking long term pictures. And then stacking all the different colors. It might be real colors or artificial colors. It's an interpolate for that. And that's where you're taking those long pictures. Or asteroid detection. You might image for 3 minutes, 4 minutes, 5 minutes on one area. And you're doing a tic-tac-toe. Why? Because you want to see that one dot go boom, 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 boom. So boom, 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 boom. I have a presentation on that one too. An asteroid.
Jupiter's constantly rotating.
And Jupiter's constantly rotating. So all my energy, when I image, I create an ADI file at the end. You practicing Jupiter. My goal is to do a full rotation. My buddy, Christopher Goh, did a research that he's out in the Philippines. He's done some beautiful full rotations of Jupiter. It's absolutely gorgeous what he does. He's got the most perfect seeing conditions, which we don't have in Virginia Beach. We just do not. Do not.
Rich Bruce Power says, he's excited. He has the same dew shield as Ben Loyola. And finally, my tour of Loyola Observatory has been realized. He said. And a number of people online have said, excellent presentation, Ben. Very good. Rachel has a question about light pollution.
Yes, a big problem. That's why I emphasize those filters so much. You can literally do a lot for yourself. If you have a basic telescope, just buy yourself an Orion Nebula or light LPS, light pollution filter, and it's relatively expensive, less than $50, whatever, and just screw that on your eyepiece, and it will make a world of difference. It really will. It knocks down the, you know, our lights produce certain frequencies. You can knock those down. It's all about signal and noise, I'm sure about.
Yeah. Bruce also asked, how would you manually adjust that ADC, whatever ADC means?
By those two handles I showed.
Okay, he said Raspberry Pi controller?
Oh, yes, yes, there's a little controller. Actually, the servo has a little controller that you can buy, a different 2-channel, 10-channel, 15 channels. It's for robotics and stuff like that. So it comes with its own little software program, but you can script it. So I have it scripted so it starts at a certain position and it ends several hours later at a different position, and it's just constantly adjusting all the way through.
So do you sometimes get meteorites or
yes,
ISS?
Yeah, ISS. I've seen ISS. I've seen satellites. I've seen all sorts of stuff. Obviously falling stars all the time.
Yep. Okay, well, thank you very much for that. Another question.
Processing, what do you mean to use your programs?
What's that?
For stacking and processing.
For stacking, okay. So I use the planetary one I use is there's no stacking involved. And afterwards, there's post processing with a couple of WinJupos is one, which does the interpolation. What it does is it takes all your flat picture, it creates as a sphere, as a model of Jupiter, and it takes every frame and wraps it in another frame and wraps it. So you figure you're doing 30 frames a second as Jupiter's moving around. It's doing this. And then all of a sudden you have to process it. I have a whole presentation on that. It locks it in first, and then it wraps it. And then so what you end up with is a whole flat it's just basically wrapped. I guess they're gonna say it wraps every picture around Jupiter and then overlays every other one. And there are thousands of them. And in the end, you have this pretty cool picture of Jupiter rotating.
You know? So you're doing a lot of like planetary work, you say.
So I like my planetary work. Yeah, Jupiter's pretty cool. The problem is because doing asteroids here in the area, you're trying to compete with the all sky surveys, and they're at 24th magnitude. You're not gonna get that in Jupiter, it's just not gonna happen.
She's going like deep sky, like Sol Nebula, like
take pretty pictures. I got pretty pictures. Yeah.
I know you do asteroids.
Asteroids, yeah. The other one is a fusion where a asteroid goes by a star. That's kind of cool too. That's really cool. So as a result, there's a team of people who get email notifications, and they show where this is in very precise timing, and then you show and you can actually create an image of the asteroid by doing that. So you get like 20, 30 people as this shadow goes across Earth and you're in the shadow path and this rocket might be a few meters, 100 meters, 200 meters, there, half a mile, and you can create this shape, you know, banana, kidney bean, whatever shape of an asteroid way the hell out there. Just by timing, taking a picture of it. And you compare all the images. There's software that pulls all the information together. There's a lot of stuff you can do. Yes, you can observe too. And Bruce Power with the observing program, I mean, he's so crazy. It's a lot of fun. Challenging. They're all challenging and fun.
Well, thank you, Ben. Based on your presentation, I think I'll stick with visual observing.
Amen.
If you need to be single to do that.
No, I'm married with two beautiful girls.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
And she's got a lunar certificate.
Your wife?
Yeah,
wife. Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Okay, time for the door prize drawing. Everybody got a ticket, right? Yep. I'll shake them up in my hand.
Hold up.
That's the one you hang on to.
I thought you were just gonna.
Okay. We'll have our presenter pick out
Remember, don't pick your own.
Okay, I promise I won't pick your own. Is that one?
Okay, I got it. 3, 6, 7, 1. Which they're all starting with that.
Oh, okay.
Woo! 5, 5, 2.
5, 5, 2.
Hey, remember. Winner of the advanced sky watching is
Kirk.
Kirk.
Got it. All right. Great.
All right. Are there any other comments or questions before we leave?
Yeah, if you guys don't want to build a whole observatory, not that you shouldn't. Don't forget the RRRT is available.
And yeah, and $1 million also.
Yeah, it's even bigger than his telescope.
A lot bigger, a lot better.
And club member Dale Carey recently had set up a sky shed. So I'll just go to our website, our Facebook page. You can see pictures of it. Okay.
Probably less money than your son.
Much.
Just a little.
All right. At 2106, meeting adjourned.
Then have you got an image of Jupiter over there?